WDRBY, Roland Derby Radio, is proud to present Q-Tips with Electrocution, legendary player for the Carolina Roller Girls. Send your questions in right now to electrocution at carolinarollergirls.com. That's ELEKTRAQTION at carolinarollergirls.com. And now, get ready for Electrocution, only on WDRBY, Roller Derby Radio.
All right, and welcome back to another Wednesday night. You're live with Q's Tips. I'm Electrocution from the Carolina Roller Girls. You can reach me at electrocution at carolinarollergirls.com, or you can find me on Facebook under Renee Q McHugh, because Facebook stole my name and still hasn't given it back. Anyway, tonight's guest is a repeat guest. It's Ryan from the Roller Derby Injury Prevention Network. Say hi, Ryan.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, it was a really great show last time, but we didn't get to everybody's questions, so we wanted to make sure that we had you on again. You were a great guest, so we really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Glad to be back.
What have you been up to for the last couple of weeks?
Not a whole lot. Just kind of living the dream one day at a time, taking care of my wife and kids, and doing some more research and getting ready for this podcast. So really excited for another show.
All right. So you said you wanted to add some corrections from the last podcast because you've been doing some research.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things that I wanted to touch base on real quick. And the first one, I'm going to eat my words a little bit here so you guys can all laugh at me just a bit. When I was listening to the podcast and just kind of reviewing what was all said last month, I heard myself say something that just kind of made me cringe a little bit, you know. And it was just one of those things that I really should have followed it up a little bit better. So I wanted to clarify something as far as what I was talking about is the limitations of emergency medical technicians. I said one line that I think could have been misconstrued if it was taken out of context. And I was discussing emergency medical technicians and the fact that making return to play decisions is not within their scope of practice, which is true. But what I really should have followed that up with is the amazing skills that emergency medical technicians do have. And I really want to just take a minute to kind of give credit where credit is due, because I really think that they have a valuable service to offer. Their expertise is emergency services. And I'll tell you what, if I have an emergency on my hand, whether that's a cardiac event or a fracture or whatever it is, I want an EMT on my side. And so I just don't think I did them justice. I really want to give them credit where credit is due, because EMTs, there's a ton of them out there in the roller derby community that are putting in volunteer hours. They're working hard. They're giving up time with their friends and family to work roller derby and make sure people are safe, okay? And that's something that the derby community really needs. And it's something that it's a reason that a lot of derby teams have something and not nothing. And I think that's very, very valuable. And so I in no way, meant to say that EMTs were not valuable. It's just that I was recognizing that they have a specific skill set, just as I have a specific skill set, so does the physician. For example, if a skater comes over and they have a shoulder dislocation, I'm not touching it. That's just not something that's within my skill set. I send that to the physician or I send that to the ER. And so I very much believe in a team approach, and where everyone kind of lives in their own little bubble, and we work together to give the best care. So anyway, just wanted to kind of clarify that if there were any EMTs out there that were upset with me just from that little comment, just want to let you know you're appreciated and keep up the great work out there. So,
well, I don't think that the EMTs feel that. I mean, I feel like EMTs are like, I don't want to be the one that sends someone back in. In fact, I've had EMTs say that. They're like, I don't want to be the one that sends someone back in when I don't know the extent of the injury. I'm here under an emergency situation,
Sure.
So I don't think that anyone got offended by that. I really don't. I think it's very important to know there are limitations to what the EMTs can do, right?
Sure.
We had a terrible incident at one of our bouts where one of our jammers went down and broke her leg in three places, and the EMTs were like, yep, it's broken. We got to get an ambulance in here right now,
Yeah.
And so they were able to inform the paramedics that came through, but they knew, they were like, we can't do anything with this. We can make you as comfortable as we can while we're waiting for the ambulance. So my hat's off to them too, because, they're on the front line, but they don't have diagnostic equipment. They don't have, she needed painkillers, major painkillers, They didn't have any of those things, but, they were there to, you know, to, they're the front line, you know, they're the first defenders.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and they're very much needed. And that's really, you know, I don't want to beat a dead horse. Just want to let them all know that, hey, you guys do a great job and keep up the good work.
Absolutely.
The second thing I wanted to touch on was a little bit about CTE. Mm-hmm. If you haven't heard about that, go listen to the podcast from last month, and we talked pretty extensively about chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But I made a quote that I just wanted to correct. I talked about the research and how it's in its infant stages, and I think I quoted that there were somewhere around 100 brains that have been studied. And I said I did some further research just to make sure that that was accurate, and the true number is closer to about 340. And that was from a recent statement by the Concussion Legacy Foundation, and they partner with the Boston University Center for CTE, and they are kind of the leaders in CTE research. So there are other entities out there that are doing CTE research, but they specifically have studied 340 brains of athletes and veterans as well. That's another kind of area that they're going into because of, you know, the explosions that they come into contact with, combat things, right, that cause concussions. So of those 340 brains, they found 200 that have tested positive for CTE, okay? Wow. So this is very recent information. This was June 11th of this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what that tells us is a couple of things. Number one, that there is an issue, okay, that this isn't just, you know, some imaginary thing that seemingly has been swept under the rug over the past few years.
Right.
But number two, it also tells us that not everybody that goes into combat or goes into collision sports ends up with CTE.
Right.
So that in terms of a percentage, you're at right around 59% if you take those two numbers and, you know, you turn them into a percentage. So that tells us that there's a lot more questions that we need to ask. And when you're, if we're not careful here, we can really kind of make this sort of dark looming cloud over this subject.
Mm-hmm.
And understandably so, because it's a very serious issue with serious implications. I mean, you know, people are killing themselves because of this disease and donating their brain to science. I mean, it's very serious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
However, as a scientist, as a healthcare professional, I like to be motivated by the facts and the evidence. And so you have to remember that when you're studying a brain, you're taking into account someone's entire life from day one all the way to the final day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that means genetic factors. That means, you know, lifestyle habits. That means drug addictions and abuse or lack thereof. That means performance enhancing drugs. It means medications, all sorts of different things. And so there's so many factors that we just don't quite yet have the evidence to say CTE is caused by collision sports. Okay.
Right.
So I understand people's concern, and I agree. I am concerned as well, but I'm not a huge proponent of being motivated by fear. Rather, I'd rather be motivated by science. You know, that being said, if you want to know my personal belief, I think in a couple of generations, yeah, we'll understand how to diagnose it in a living person. And by the way, I just read an article the other day that a doctor thinks that he has come up with a way to diagnose CTE in a living person.
Is it by doing like a blood scan or something?
It's actually, from what I'm understanding, they're using a specialized form of PET scan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need to do more reading on that to fully understand it. But I believe it's going to be pretty soon in the next, you know, 10, 20 years that we're going to start to gain a lot more ground on this, answer some more questions. But, you know, again, right now, we can't definitively say that, okay, you play collision sports, you're going to get CTE. It's just not there. But I believe in the future generations, we are going to respond to that. And it already has been happening where rule changes are being made and sports look very, very differently. And they're going to continue to look differently than they do today. And I think that's a really good thing. So.
Well, I guess that's good news and bad news.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, you have a lot of you know, young kids who are now, instead of playing full contact tackle football, are playing flag football, which
right.
again is great. You know,
yep.
it seems to make sense again, like we said last month, that the less hits that you can receive to the head over your lifetime, the better.
Yeah, so. Exactly. You know, yeah. I was just thinking about the who's a, I don't want to say bicycle, but he used to do jumps and tricks and everything on his bicycle, and he just committed suicide. I can't remember his name.
Dave. Mira,
David yes, Mira, I think yes, was. And yeah. they believe he had CTE, and he was very young.
Yeah, I could be mistaken, but I'm fairly sure that did come back positive. I'll have to double check, but okay. I thought I remember seeing that he did come back positive for CTE.
Yeah, and I could just imagine, you know, he was doing these crazy tricks all the time, and
yeah,
you know, you hit your head, you know.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, anyway, yeah, thanks for letting me just take a couple minutes to clarify those. We can go ahead and move on with the other questions, or unless there's anything else that you want to discuss.
Sure. No, we've got plenty of questions, and the first one is I put in a couple of my own, actually. So the first question I have is, do you see specific injuries for specific positions on the track, such as, like, are there jammer injuries? Are there more common blocker injuries? Do you see those things?
Yeah, I mean, I'll preface this with saying that there's no evidence to back this up. I'll just kind of give you my personal experience mm-hmm. and my general observations that in general, the jammers tend to have kind of the more catastrophic injuries, the crazy injuries, because they're going flying into the pack and then, you know, hitting a brick wall, essentially, if they mm-hmm. make a wrong move, mm-hmm. right? They have to be more agile. They have to be quicker, speedier. And I remember a lot of knee injuries, especially in blockers, you know, because they're either getting hit from behind, falling directly down on their knees.
Yes.
Blockers tend to be a little bit larger mm-hmm. than the jammers. And so you have all their weight coming down on the knee when maybe in a smaller person that wouldn't sprain a PCL, for example.
Right.
So, you know, in general, I think blockers tend to have some more knee injuries, and the jammers tend to have the kind of larger injuries. But I'd need a little bit of more evidence to back that up for sure.
So. Yeah, I was just wondering because I think I see that same thing too. I see a lot more catastrophic injury coming from the jammer position and a lot more like nagging injuries coming from the blocker position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know, and I'm, you know, having played both, I tell you, I've gotten messed up both times. You know, yeah, so right. It's like, oh, I've gotten injured right. being a blocker. I've gotten injured being a jammer, but I've gotten more severe injuries being a jammer. And yeah. that could just be my skill level.
Yeah. What's the worst injury you ever had?
I didn't break it. Someone else broke it for me. I broke my part of my hand. Oof. And I was protecting my face because I was down on the ground and the girl still hit me. So it's
wow.
called a boxer's break. And yep. I didn't know it was, well, I kind of knew it was broken at the time. I got back up and jammed, finished the jam. Went to the EMTs at halftime, and I was like, I think this is broken.
Yeah.
And they pulled off my wrist guard, and it was really painful. And they were like, yeah, it's broken. And I was like, well, can you just put my wrist guard back on, and I'll go back out? And they were like, no.
right, yeah.
And they sent me to the hospital immediately. So once again, you know, there's that EMT telling me, you know, I prefer you didn't go back into play, but, you know, it's your choice.
It's okay. It's a good choice.
Yeah, it was a good choice. It was. It was smart. Because I could have had surgery because, you know, hands are very tricky. So I was lucky not to.
Right.
All right. And the next question, I think this came from this weekend, and I'll explain in a little second. But do you who is ultimately responsible for your safety on the track and in this sport? And the reason I ask this is because this weekend we had an interesting situation, and it is no fault with the team we were playing, but our A team and B team went up and played at a venue which was over an ice skating rink, and they had placed the track down over this, and I think the venue did not put a moisture guard between the ice and the sport court, and during the B team bout, the water just started seeping up. It just started coming up, and the people were sliding around everywhere. And I was thinking, who would have called that game? Because the All-Stars, the A-team, and the other A-team, we decided that was not appropriate for a sanctioned game. But I was just thinking, gosh, you know, if I were on the B-team, I'd want someone to say something like, maybe we should stop the game. This seems dangerous. Nobody could stay on their feet. You know, nobody could. You couldn't use your edges. You couldn't use your toe stops. You just slid everywhere.
Yeah, so I think this is something that falls directly, this environmental issue, okay, mm-hmm. specifically falls within the scope of practice of an athletic trainer, okay, in the United States. So if I were covering your bout and I saw that and people were slipping, I would have a legal, moral, ethical responsibility to say something.
Okay.
Because I also have training in that, okay. But if you don't have that, well, then you kind of have to fall back on what you do have. People that would, you know, it would be appropriate to say something would be someone like the safety director or mm-hmm. the safety co-chair would be a good person. The official. Now, I know there's been a lot of kind of back and forth about what the officials are responsible for and what they're not. I'm not quite sure what the WFTDA safety protocol says on environmental issues and officials, but my guess is that if there's a safety issue, because a lot of the rules are surrounding safety issues, my guess is that, well, it's reasonable to expect an official to say, we're going to get this taken care of. I'd say it's, you know, it's kind of the same thing with blood, although blood is a little bit different. But when blood's on the ground, they don't let game, they don't let the game resume until the blood's cleaned up.
Right.
If the environment is unsafe, it's somebody's responsibility to speak up, you know. And I don't know, you know, who that is, but I would say, you know, your safety co-chair, your team physician, your EMTs, anyone certainly can speak up. I mean, just because you don't have somebody that's not trained in recognizing environmental risk factors doesn't mean that we can just kind of forget common sense, right?
Right. Because I know that people, you know, it's one of those sports where it's like, well, if we put it on this whole thing, we have a public game, there's a lot of pressure, you know, you have an audience. But then again, it's like, this is not safe, you know?
Right. And really, you know, as a general answer to your question, you know, who's responsible for safety on the track, or who's responsible for the safety of the skaters? Really, you're the one that's lacing up those skates and choosing to get on the track. So as a person who is competing in the activity, there's a very large portion, in my opinion, that falls on the skater. And if you feel that it's unsafe, then I think there's a responsibility there that you need to speak up and say something. And so I am a definite fan of a team approach, you know, but if there's something wrong, it can't go ignored, you know?
So. Well, and I think to piggyback on this, Magic, one of the players, well, actually the girl that got injured, you know, catastrophically a couple weeks ago, she wrote in and she says, this is not a question, but I wish there was an exact answer as to when enough is enough in regards to injuries and continuing to play a sport. Like, if A, B, and C happen, you need to stop playing. I'm worried I'm going to keep playing derby until my body is a wreck and I will be crippled by 60. So this is sort of piggybacking on when is it, you know, who's responsible for your safety kind of thing. You know, when is it, and when do you stop playing the sport?
Yeah, that's a great question, and she hits it right on the head. You know, there's really no sort of cookie-cutter answer. Anytime you play collision sports, especially as an adult, your body, it takes a beating on your body, or gives your body a beating, basically, and your body starts to wear down over time. You know, I'm 32 years old. I don't recover the same way as I did when I was 16, right?
Right,
you know,
exactly.
Even after a workout, you know, it's just not the same. And as you age, your ability to heal, your ability to bounce back from an injury goes one direction, and it's not up, it's down, you know?
And boy, do I know that at 46.
Right. So, you know, retirement, I very much see as a personal decision. I know a lot of people who just say after 5 years, you know what? I fulfilled my purpose. I think I'm done. And that's totally fine. You know, the one line that I tend to draw in the sand has to do with head injuries. I know we talked about this a little bit before. But you know, the current literature suggests that if you are sustaining concussions that are more easily acquired, meaning a smaller force gives you a concussion than before, and they're more intense and longer lasting than before, and you kind of tend to get this sort of like downward spiral with your head injuries, then it's time to consider retirement. But you know, as far as the other aches and pains go, it's a risk of the sport for sure. You know, when you fall on your knees over and over, yeah, you're going to give yourself some early onset arthritis, or at least your chances go up, you know. So it's definitely an inherent risk of the sport, and you have to be willing to accept that, or you know, choose not to play, and that's okay too, you know.
Well, and it's funny because I think everybody has that like line in the sand for themselves, and I think you have to really sit down with your, you know, yourself, your maybe your significant other, maybe your family, you know, because these are the people that may have to take care of you if you hit that line in the sand. You know what I mean? So, you know, for me, it always was, am I going to need surgery, you know, to recover from this injury? Is this injury, you know, like let's say I popped an ACL, that would have been the end of roller derby for me, because I'm not going back out after I have a reconstructed ACL. Just not gonna, you know. Yeah. And I understand that people do it, but for me personally, I wouldn't want to go through that again, you know, because I've seen people repop ACLs after they've had them for only like 2 years.
Yeah, no good.
So I'm not a fan.
I agree.
So I always
think everybody. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to agree with you. I think everybody needs to have their line, and if that line is crossed, then okay, then it's time to be done. But you know, I've seen girls skate without ACLs, and you know, they wear an ACL brace, and every once in a while their knee shifts, and they kind of, you know, essentially, for lack of a better term, kind of dislocate their knee or sublux their knee a little bit, and it hurts for a little while. It swells up for a couple days or a couple weeks, and then they get back to it. You know, and not in my opinion the best choice, but they choose to do that, and that's their choice. You know, as far as I'm concerned, as long as safety is not an issue and you're able to perform at a high level, well, then you have a lot of gray area, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and I think it's interesting to note that we had a lady that skated with us, and she was a little bit older than I was. She had popped her ACL, I think, when she was 30, and she was almost 50 when she was skating, and she never had an issue. She never subluxed her knee, and she just was very strong. You know, she had all the muscles around that knee really tight and strong, and she was fine with it. And then, you know, she now does mountain biking. So, you know, I'm just like, well, dang.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Next question, just really quick while we're talking about injuries and injury prevention. The Ish, she's another girl that skates with us. She says, not too much of a question, but from what I've seen and what I've had to experience myself is remembering that if you are injured, you need to take the correct amount of time off and do the correct things like physical therapy to get back. Because if you come back too soon, you can do more damage than you originally did. Is this what you find to be is a truthful statement?
Yeah, 100%. And I'll add on to that. It's very, very important that you have someone who's experienced the knowledge in sports medicine, whether that's an athletic trainer, physical therapist, physician, somebody should be overseeing your care. And it's kind of like what we talked about last month. If you're not, your tendon played the guessing game and you just go off of kind of what you know or what you feel, which isn't necessarily bad or wrong. But there's a difference between that and someone who specializes in helping you make that leap back to play. So telling you how much rest to have, how to treat those injuries, what types of medications to take, what, you know, ice or heat or, you know, whatever. Very, very important to have that guidance if it's available to you. And if it's not available to you, reach out to us. We'll help you make it happen.
Nice. All right. So let's get back to some of those questions from last week. Sarah Riggs wrote in and said, should leagues be using baseline testing and simple concussion tests, or is the SCAT3 assessment the way to go?
Yeah, Sarah, great question. Thanks for sending it over to us. So for baseline testing, is it a good idea? Yeah, absolutely. Kind of the gold standard is neurocognitive computer testing, and there's a few different companies out there that do it. I've used Impact baseline testing before, and you can also use that as a comparison to after somebody gets injured. You have them retake the test, and then it gives you like this kind of objective printout of how they performed, testing their memory, testing their reaction time, speed, etc. And the tricky part about that is it takes a physician to order that, and and a physician and maybe an athletic trainer to administer those tests. So you have to have somebody involved in your club to order those tests for you. They do cost money; they're not free. You know, so
what do they run generally? Can you tell me?
You know, I want to say a lot of concussion clinics will charge something like between $20 and $50 a test.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what the actual price is from the company itself. I want to say it's like $25 a test, but don't quote me on that. I really have no idea. I'm just guessing. But they'll also sell you like certain packages or something. You buy 500 tests for a certain price or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that has to be done through a physician. So if you don't have that, a SCAT3 is another way to do it. SCAT3 stands for Sports Concussion Assessment Tool 3. It's the third edition. That should be administered by an athletic trainer at least, or a physician. But again, if you don't have that, you know, it's really hard to do any sort of baseline testing because if you don't have someone who's trained in doing it,
right.
you don't want to step across that line and just pick up a SCAT3 and start doing that, because you're opening yourself up to a tremendous amount of liability. So what I would say, and I talk about this in the Roller Derby Concussion Project, it's on our YouTube channel, take a look. As a minimum, I like to have each coach and captain an official with a pocket CRT. Okay, that's a pocket-sized concussion recognition tool. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it gives you a little pocket-sized card to take you through a concussion assessment should one happen. And then, you know, I like the three R's of layperson concussion awareness, and that's recognize, respond, and refer. So you recognize that there might be an issue, you respond to it and you pull them out of play, and if you find any positive findings on that pocket CRT, then you refer them to a healthcare provider immediately for further evaluation. So, but as far as baseline testing goes, yeah, it's a great idea, but ideally you should have someone doing it for you that's trained.
Absolutely. And I think that's probably why a lot of leagues don't do it.
Right. Well, it's a large undertaking. I mean, doing a baseline testing for an entire team, you know, of 100 people or whatever it is, a league, you know, it takes a lot of work. There's a lot of moving parts. I did it in Milwaukee, and it took us, I want to say, a year and a half before we even started that initiative. Mm-hmm. And then kind of on the second, between the second and third season, I think we kind of voted that into the league as something that we were going to do. But yeah, it takes a lot of man hours. It takes time out of everybody's schedule. It takes money. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have to rent a library or something like that, but ideally, you know, you can do it in kind of a group setting where you're testing multiple people at once. And
nice.
it's just a lot of coordination that takes place. So.
Alrighty. Okay. So next question is Rhoda B. Mean. And she says, my most recent predicament is a nagging groin injury. And groin is a funny word for me. So I know. So do you know there is like no information on female groin injuries? My lady bits hurt from this, and I can't even figure out if this is normal because every article I look up on the subject thinks only people with testes get groin injuries. I'm seeing a doctor, so don't worry about me. But for the sake of sanity, share this information. Number two, yeah. This being my first groin injury, I have no idea if there are symptoms I should be worried about. RE, lady bits hurting from above. Super super frustrated with the subject at the moment, so it would be really cool to hear about it.
Say lady bits one more time.
I know, like groin and lady bits. It's awesome.
Yeah, good. Great question, Rhoda B. Mean. Thank you. So groin injuries in general, they're a pain. Like they really are. They take forever to heal, whether that's like a regular, like a muscular or a tendon strain. They're not fun to deal with, and they take weeks and months to heal. And the reason is because the groin, or the adductor muscle group is what we call them. It starts kind of in the inside, high in the groin, and then goes down along the thigh and kind of inserts like right on the inside of the knee.
Yeah.
And it's used in walking. It's stretched every time you stride in skating. I mean, it's just anytime you do anything, you're using your adductor muscles somehow. So it really depends on what the true issue is. Now for this, you know, keep in mind, Rhoda, I'm not your doctor. I can't give you specific healthcare advice, right? But I think you're barking up the right tree by going to see your doctor, especially if the lady bits are hurting, for sure. Mm-hmm. If they're involved, you really need to be seeing somebody, ideally someone who either specializes in sports medicine or a gynecologist. I think either one of those would be very appropriate to start with.
Mm-hmm.
As far as specific things that you know, it could be in terms of just general groin injuries, there's a few things to think about. Number one, it could be an adductor strain, okay, either on the muscle itself or on the tendon as it attaches to the bone. Sometimes you can even tear that off of the bone.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, right. And so, you know, if there's any doubt in your mind, it's just best to go see somebody and be evaluated, because there's certain signs and symptoms that they'll look for that you won't be able to pick up on, okay?
Right.
And it could mean the difference between, you know, surgery or not surgery. So you just have to be very careful with that.
How do you prevent these? Because now I'm worried about them.
Yeah. Flexibility and fitness is pretty important. You know, good mechanics is also very important. So groin stretching is something that you want to do on a regular basis, and you know, get a good warm up, a good cool down. Those are a lot of good things that you can do to help prevent the groin injury. Just in general, good health and fitness practices, mm-hmm. you know, can avoid a lot of issues like that. So the other thing you may want to think about is it could be a hernia. And if you're already seeing a doctor, I imagine they probably checked you for this. Now, I'm not terribly familiar what the incidence is with hernias in women. I know it's fairly common in men. Basically, the abdominal wall kind of weakens, mm-hmm. and you get this intestine that pops out. And a lot of times it can go down into the scrotum. which is why, you know, you have this kind of joke, you know, with the teenage physicals where they turn their head and cough, right?
Right.
Well, that's what they're looking for, okay, is the intestine poking down into the scrotum. And the other thing it could be is a sports hernia. And sports hernia is kind of a funny misnomer because it's not a true hernia.
Right.
And sports hernia is like this kind of like it's this ruled out injury, meaning like we don't know what else it is, so we're going to call it a sports hernia.
Okay. Know,
which is totally ridiculous if you think about
it. It's the UFO of injuries.
Yeah, exactly. But it's basically a chronic groin pain. The last thing I'll mention is a condition called osteitis pubis, okay? Osteitis pubis. And basically what that is where your pelvic bone meets right above your genital area.
Mm-hmm.
There's kind of this hard bump, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's your pubic bone, your two pubic bones where they meet.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little disc in between those two bones. It's like a cartilaginous disc, like cartilage, right?
Mm-hmm.
And basically its job is to kind of allow a little bit of movement, absorb some shock, and basically connect the two pelvic bones as they meet in the center, okay?
Huh.
Now, a lot of times you can just get inflammation in there for either from repetitive strain or for no reason at all. But you know, what I would recommend is, again, if you're having problems with the genital area, make sure you're seeing a physician right away. You may even want to consider seeing a physical therapist if you have not already. Find somebody who specializes in women's health. That's a whole subspecialty in and of itself, something that I certainly can't even speak to, but, you know, it deals with things like pelvic floor and Kegel exercises, lumbopelvic stability, things that are very specific to women that could really benefit you. So.
Well, and it sounds like it could benefit a lot of people in roller derby, since one of the biggest fears, I think, for women out there is getting hit hard enough to pee yourself. So.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's a thing.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah, do those Kegels lately because it'll help.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so yeah, great question. You know, groin injuries, they're a pain. You're right. There's not a lot of great information out there. So see a doctor and get the help that you need, for sure.
All right. Next question is from Nathan Bettis. He skates with Collision, and he also skates with us as our on-skates coach. And he said, are there things we can do as a sport to improve our officiating standards to prevent injuries, specifically head injuries?
Yeah. I think there definitely is. And but I'll say this, is that the derby officials that I've worked with have been absolutely fantastic. And I would say quite well educated, especially when it comes to head injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been very willing to work with me, especially if I have, you know, a skater who, you know, for example, is like, you know, giving me a hard time about a, you know, oh, I'm not really concussed or whatever. And, you know, they're really willing to work with us to kind of come to solution together on that so that everybody's safe, you know? And so, you know, as far as things that you can do, sport-wide education is really key. That's the whole reason we came up with the Derby Injury, the Derby Concussion Project, was
mm-hmm.
to just put great information out there that anybody can access for free, and
mm-hmm.
and then they've got a really good education, a good solid foundation on head injuries specifically. So we're continuing to work towards further education specifically with head injuries. We've got some ideas for a website and things like that are coming down the pipe, but I think there can always be more, you know, because things are changing so fast that, you know, I mean, like I said, I even had updates from last month that,
right,
that we
exactly
touch on, you know, so it's a good thing. But yeah, continuing education, I would say, is the main thing for sure.
Well, I feel like, you know, people are starting to become more aware of head injuries and concussions, and I think that is that shows just what the questions that we're fielding right now. But I think it's interesting because the refs, they have to call those high blocks or leading with the head and all that, but they really have to cover the entire body of a skater, you know, because they're checking for, you know, cuts with the feet, you know, hips placements for points, you know, and all the other thing, back blocks, you know, arm place, and then you've got to add to their, you know, repertoire, they have to look for head injury or possible head injury or possible head foul, you know, I mean, that's a lot to do.
Yeah, they really have their work cut out for them, and you know, I think it's just like anything else, they act within their scope of duty, what they're supposed to do, and they don't feel the need to necessarily step outside of that. So, you know, really, as far as the ref is concerned, if you suspect a head injury, your job is to pull them out of play and refer them right away to somebody who can evaluate them, and then they've done their job and they've done it well, and, mm-hmm. and that's enough. You know, mm-hmm. they don't need to come in and play the hero. You know, and like I said, mostly I've never even had a problem with a ref. I mean, they're just really really good about being respectfully cautious of head injuries. You know, mm-hmm. so.
Yeah, and it's hard. I don't know if there is an answer to that. The way the sport is, you know, people are going to get hit in the head. So, and the refs can't see everything on the track. I mean, you have seven refs, but that's still, sometimes it doesn't seem like it's enough. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, and really, that's why we are there. We are right there to watch for injuries. You know, and granted, we're not going to see everything, right? But that's why you have a team there. You know, mm-hmm. ideally, that's the goal, is you have a team of people so that if person one doesn't see it, well, person two says, hey, I saw something a little bit shaky there. Let's see what we can do to make sure you're okay.
You Absolutely.
Know? So.
All right. Next question is from Deanna Danger. If you could pick the top 3 to 5 easy / simple things you can add to your daily routine to help prevent injury, what would they be?
Yeah. Awesome. Deanna Danger. Thank you so much from Milwaukee. She's throwing us a question. Thanks again. Yeah, I think we touched a little bit on this last time, but if I would pick, say, 3 to 4 things to give people advice in terms of what can you do to improve your skills or whatever, your overall athleticism, I would say, number one, try to adopt an athletic lifestyle, or at least make small changes here and there of different things that you can you find ways to improve your lifestyle, whether it's eating better, getting a little bit more protein, avoiding that extra soda, maybe skip that second dessert this week or whatever that you
what?
Have. Yeah, right. to really adopt that sort of, again, athletic mindset. You know, sleeping regularly is a really important thing, making sure you're getting plenty of sleep and rest, not just in terms of, you know, physical sleep and rest, but, you know, make sure you're getting a break from Derby every now and again. Mm-hmm. You know, make sure that you're not going crazy with the full contact practices 3, 4, 5 times a week. I think that's really important. You know, we talked about other habitual changes like smoking. I think that's a really good one. If you are a smoker, try and get off of it as soon as possible. It can only help you, not only your athletic performance, but your overall health.
Well, exactly. I don't know how people do any kind of cardio and be smokers at this point. Right?
Sure.
Other than they're very young.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than that, it's like, hey, you know, train outside of Derby. And even if it's only once a week, okay, it's something, you know. So start small, take baby steps, and over time you will start to develop that athletic lifestyle for sure.
Well, and I think it's addictive, you know.
Yeah.
You start with little things, and then you're like, well, I could add this to my, you know, repertoire, and I could add this to my repertoire, and you start researching things and trying new things, and you'll see what works for you. What works for you may not work for someone else.
Right, right.
You know, I always say, people are always like, well, how did you build your endurance? I'm like, well, when I started Derby, all I did was ride my bike everywhere.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Up and yeah. down hills, you know, and but that doesn't work for everybody. Not everybody likes riding a bike. Not everybody's comfortable on it. Maybe they don't have a place to ride like I do. So.
Right.
You know, it's whatever works for you. You have to make it work for you. I'm not a gym rat. I don't like going to the gym. I like working out at home or, you know, with my team somewhere. But I don't like paying to go to the gym. I just, it's not good for me. It doesn't work. I won't go, you know. It's a waste of money. So I work out at home. But what works for me may not work for someone else and vice versa.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think finding your niche and sticking with that is definitely beneficial.
Absolutely. All right, next question. As the sport is always evolving, what are the new things you are starting to worry about? Example, backwards blocking opens the risk of getting hit hard in the rib cage, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm seeing a bit more of kind of this wrong way opposite contact that's happening. And I'm not entirely sure of the new rules on all of that, but I'm just noticing that I'm seeing it more.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there were some rule changes a couple of years ago where girls started to kind of use their arms quite a bit more. You know, like they, right. I think they had made some rule changes where you could grab more or something like that.
It's not grabbing, but you can definitely, and it always has been there, but most people never block like this, but you can use from the shoulder down to the elbow as long as you're not moving it.
Okay.
So, people are using it like as an extension of their bodies.
Okay, got it. Got it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, anytime you have a limb hanging out like that, or, you know, your fingers get caught on things. And so that certainly can increase the risk for injury. The other thing that's a little bit more of like a kind of a broad, I don't know if I'd call it a concern, but it's just something that we need to be aware of, is that when these young skaters come in or these new skaters come in, we have to make sure that their skills are up to snuff and they're learning how to train properly, learning how to skate and stop, and, you know, we're not compromising in any way their skills to make sure that they're actually safe to play. And so that's I would say a biggie, is that train up that new generation of roller derby athletes in a way that they're set up to succeed for sure.
Yeah, and I think there are a lot of leagues that, you know, they're suffering for membership, so they're kind of rushing people through the fresh meat program and throwing them into bouts, not necessarily when they're ready, but because they need people, you know, or they're afraid that someone's not going to want to train for, you know, for a long time and get good. They don't want to lose them. They don't want them to get frustrated. You know, they want them to get to the fun stuff. And that's great, except for that's probably going to shorten that person's derby career at the very least.
Yeah, exactly. And I think patience is a huge part of that. I mean, Rome wasn't built in a day. It takes time to build a derby organization. And I, of course, don't really know what's all involved in that. But I know that, you know, I'm sure that Carolina Roller Girls had somewhat humble beginnings. And, you know, it took them time to get to where they're at now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's just like any other startup, you know. And so I think being patient with the process is very important, and emphasizing perfect technique, or as close to perfect as you can get, right? Above anything else, and general health and fitness is really important. So,
exactly. And I'm a big stickler, is that person has to be stable and safe. We do our assessments in two parts. We do, you know, the basic skills, and then we do the pack assessment. And I may be like, well, you need to work on your Mohawk, but I'm more concerned about how, you know, how you are on the track. Are you able to, you know, are you stable? Are you comfortable? Are you not overwhelmed, you know, because you're thinking about skating instead of thinking about playing the game.
Right.
And that's a huge difference. And it's hard to tell that to someone, why, you know, hey, you didn't pass pack and here's why. And they're like, well, I don't understand exactly what I have to do.
Right.
And you're like, it's the comfort level of your skating as, you know, under pressure.
Yeah, and I think it's real important for, you know, some sort of kind of like mentorship program to almost develop, you know, where the experienced skaters take the younger ones or the more inexperienced skaters under their wings and really show them the ropes. I think that's a really huge part of, you know, building teamwork, building camaraderie, and also keeping them safe, you know.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so next question is from Catherine Wall. Or Scufflepuff, she skates with our league. All right, she has quite a few questions, because she's had some nagging injuries trying to get into roller derby, so she's very like fixated on what she can do to make herself stronger, and I think that's good. And number one is, what kinds of conditioning exercises do you find best for keeping a skater injury free, or for reducing the likelihood of when an injury does happen, it won't be as severe?
So with this, there's a few things that I would recommend. Number one is movement, repatterning, learning to use your hips, okay? When people hear the term lift with your legs, not with your back, they form a certain picture in their mind's eye, and it usually looks like kind of a squat, which is not necessarily bad or wrong. But if you learn to use your hips, you can generate power through your glutes. So hip movement activation exercises, glute strengthening exercises, ankle and calf stretches are very important for ankle injury prevention. Balance and stability exercises are also very important. And I know we're beating a dead horse with this, but general fitness and strength and conditioning is also very important. What I would recommend is, if you're very serious about injury prevention, find a physical therapist, an athletic trainer, chiropractor, some sort of healthcare provider that specializes in functional movement, okay? And what they will do is they'll take you through a functional movement exam, and they will tease out certain areas in your body of weakness or compensation, tightness, et cetera, and they'll tailor an exercise program to you to kind of fix what's going on in your body to make sure everything is in alignment and working properly and playing nicely together, and that will optimize your athletic performance.
Yeah, so, we actually went through this with our league. We have physical therapists that are willing to do this kind of thing for us, and it was really interesting to find out. You know, I was terrified to go through it because I'm an older skater, right? So I'm like, I'm not going to have any flexibility, and I'm not going to. And I was actually doing really well. They were really surprised, you know. So, but it was nice to know that they were there to help correct anything that they saw. You know, they were like, hey, do this to help you do this, you know. And that was the first time I was introduced to a BOSU ball.
Okay.
For my ankles, because my ankles are too flexible. And I was like, oh my God, this thing's hideous, but I love it now, you know. I was like, who made this up? Some torture, you know?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And even if you have to do it on an individual basis, and even if you have to pay a little bit of money for it, it's worth it 100% because you become much more in tune with your body and you start to understand the physics and the science behind your body. And I think that's really important for injury prevention. So
very cool. All right. Number two, are there injuries that are common in newer skaters that you see less often in experienced skaters? If so, what can training programs do to help fresh meat avoid those beginner injuries?
Yeah. So there's a couple of categories that I see with the newer skaters. Number one is the catastrophic injuries. Well, and catastrophic isn't necessarily the right term, but it's more serious. You know, the fractures that need surgery, the ankle fractures, the injuries that'll keep them out for longer periods of time. And I think what that comes down to is inexperience and, you know, just making the judgment calls that maybe they shouldn't have, you know?
Right.
Or sometimes it's just freak accidents, you know? The other is I tend to see more gray area injuries with them as well because they're learning what feels like soreness and what feels like injury and trying to understand the difference.
Right. You know? I always say discomfort versus pain. You know?
Yep. Exactly. And so, you know, training programs to I don't know that a bunch of training programs would help with that. I mean, I know we touched on a lot of other things. You know, unfortunately, experience will help that that gray area injury sort of pattern where they're kind of learning what's sore and what's injury. You know, other than that, I don't know that I have a bunch of really good suggestions for that, you know.
Well, I think a lot of times it's when I see a really, you know, what not necessarily catastrophic, but something that'll put them out for a while, it's because they stiffen up on the skates as opposed to like they stand up, they get, you know, their body goes into that fight or flight and they stand up and they get nervous and they, you know, fall hard or they twist something because they're stiff and hard. And it's the idea is that, you know, you need to be familiar enough on your skates to know how your body's going to react. Yeah. So the more time you can spend on your skates, not necessarily doing anything crazy, you know, not because you're not pushing yourself when you're at group skate, you know, when you're at an open skate, you're just skating. But even then, that time will get you more comfortable on your skates so you know what's going to happen. I think that's the biggest thing I see is that stiffening up or standing up and it makes it worse, you know, whatever the fall would be or the twist would be.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that for sure. I mean, you kind of have to get to the point where your skates become an extension of your foot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like they become a part of you. And that takes time, unfortunately. And it lots of practice, like you're saying.
Yep, it really does. But, I mean, there are ways to do it without putting yourself at risk for injury. And you can do it like going to open, you know, skills. You can go to a speed practice, which is a non-contact practice, you know. You know, I've even seen people go trail skating. I think trail skating is a little bit more dangerous because you've got different terrain that you're dealing with. So, you know, and you could fall pretty hard. But, you know, if you can do it in like an outdoor, you know, hockey rink, you know, that's for wheels, you can do it in a lot of places. You can go to a parking lot and skate. There are a lot, if you can't get to a roller skating rink all the time, there are ways to get around that.
Yeah, yeah, you definitely have to be creative in that. Yeah, those are a lot of good suggestions I would agree with.
All right, and her third question is, the gear choices can be overwhelming. Do you have specific recommendations for the different pieces of protective gear that skaters wear? For example, are there features you should always look for in a wrist guard or styles of a particular piece of gear that you think are more or less protective than others generally?
Yeah, so as far as equipment goes, you know, the last podcast we did, we talked a lot about helmets. So if you're curious about helmets, go listen to that. Because we just beat that to death for sure. Okay. Yeah. But a lot of good information there. You know, kind of moving down the body a little bit, as far as wrist guards go, I like the ones that have a plate on either side of the wrist.
Oh, yeah.
I think 888 has them. Yes.
888 has them. ProTech has them. 187s have them. The ones that don't are the old Atom Gear versions, and they have no back piece to them. And I'm always worried about that, because that back piece helps shunt the force away from those little bones in your wrist.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, why would you not want it?
Yeah, exactly. And so the purpose of those two plates is the one on the palmer side prevents wrist hyperflexion, or kind of forward motion of the wrist. Mm-hmm. The one on the back prevents wrist hyperextension. So you've basically got two direction of motions that are protected should you take a bad fall. And I personally think those just protect a little bit better.
Sure.
Versus some of the other ones I've seen that literally look like you just kind of slapped a piece of fabric on your hand and put a piece of plastic on there. You know what I mean?
And
it just doesn't look like it does anything.
Right. And having had a hand injury in the last 2 years, you really want to protect your hands, because God, you use them for everything, right? So, you know, please be careful with that, you know, make sure that you have proper wrist protection, because you don't want to be out of your day job because you can't do the job.
Yeah, thank you. I could give you a hug right now. It's so true. It's so true.
It is.
As far as knee pads go, I'm a big fan of gaskets.
Me too.
The reason I love gaskets is because I think they take one more step to kind of protect the condyles of the femur. Okay, and the condyles are basically those two round bulbous ends of the femur that, mm-hmm. that are inside your knee. Okay, and those are covered with white, smooth articular cartilage. Okay, and what that does is it acts as a shock absorber for the knee and makes sure that your knee can kind of move fluidly, you mm-hmm. know. And so once you start to bang those condyles over and over and over again, that cartilage takes a beating and it starts to degenerate over time, and that can cause early onset arthritis. And once you have arthritis, again, that's one of those things that just goes one direction, and it only goes worse.
Right.
So, you know, is it going to prevent it? Maybe. You know what I mean? Like, it's again, one of those things you have to be careful how much faith you put into a piece of equipment.
Right.
But I would say it's better than not having it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there's some people out there that don't skate with them. And I always, you know, I don't say anything like, you're dumb. But in my head, I'm like, you're dumb.
Yeah, right.
It really does. And I feel, you know, just even as a skater, it also keeps my joints warmer.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
So it's like, that's also good for me being older. You know, things don't, you have to warm up a little longer sometimes. And it's just, that helps. So anything that helps.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And then she asks, what pieces of optional protective gear do you think more skaters should wear?
Yeah, you know, I've seen a few things here and there. One of the things I've noticed recently is shin guards.
I wear them.
Do you? Okay.
Yep, I've worn them since 2009.
Reasonable. Okay, and how do you like them when you wear them? What benefit do you get out of them?
Well, the reason I put them on is because a girl in front of me, a very good skater, by the way, kicked back with the plate of her, and she caught me right in the shin, and I said, oh my God.
No kidding.
It was one of the worst pains I've ever been in, and I said, why am I not wearing shin guards? This is ridiculous. Yeah. These people have metal on their feet. And when I went out and bought them, I got the ones with the stirrups on the bottom. They're just soccer guards, you know. So I went out and bought them, and I've, you know, I change them out probably every 2 years because they last for a while. They're $20 usually, but they really saved my life. You can see it on the shin guards when, you know, you look at the shin guards, there's like a giant gash across them because someone's kicked them, you know?
Yeah.
And and I know that can actually cause some fractures in your shin and, you know, all sorts of good stuff. So I'm very lucky that I picked that up, but I got a lot of crap the first time I wore them. Oh, you must suck as a skater. I'm like, no, I don't kick myself, you know.
Yeah, right. And yeah, I mean, man, it hurts. It hurts.
Oh, it's a terrible. I saw stars.
With a wheel. Yeah, no kidding. Yeah,
so bad. And it's funny, when Bonnie Thunders was wearing hers in 2010, I was like, ha! Nobody gave me shit after that.
There you go. I like it.
So you got to get someone really like famous or well liked to wear it, and then they'll shut up about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's very reasonable to wear. Sure. You know, I would recommend something somewhat low profile. Mm-hmm. And you can Google roller derby shin guards and find a slew of them. They're out there. The other thing I've seen more and more is pelvic girdles. Okay, so kind of like the hockey breezer pants style.
Yes.
Pants.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
I think they used to call those hillbillies back in the day.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Why is that?
I don't know. I think that was just the brand. Oh, so they had it. It was the hillbilly brand of, and you know, it protected, you know, your tailbone, it protected your hips, it protected a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've seen girls wear that. I think that's, again, very reasonable. Certainly something optional that can save you some bumps and bruises as well. So, yeah, definitely would recommend those if you're at all concerned about shin or pelvic injuries. So.
And I got to tell you, I've seen them. You know, we've seen people get really – I have a dead spot on my hip from falling and, you know, hitting people. Like, I probably could set it on fire and I wouldn't feel it at this point. It's just because it's been so – like bruised up and scarred up and damaged at this point. But, you know, not everybody wants to have that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So, you know, when you see someone wearing extra, and I will say this, when you see someone wearing extra protective gear, don't give them crap, because that's a safety thing. You know, if they want to wear extra protective gear, I mean, I've gotten it every time I've done something out of the norm in roller derby, like, oh, the shin guards. And I mean, there was a full year of just getting, you know, crapped on for the shin guards. And then 2013, I had a hockey helmet, and oh my God, you look stupid. I'm like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's so surprising. Yeah. That's so surprising to me.
But it was interesting. And then, you know, I started getting a face shield. People were like, oh, you're being stupid with your face shield, you know. And I'm like, why do you care what I wear? And then, you know, people slowly adopt it and slowly get used to it, but there's a lot of pushback at first. So if you are one of these people that needs to wear something extra, don't feel bad about it. Just do it.
Yeah.
They'll get over it.
No safety shaming.
Yeah. Either that, or they'll get over it, or they'll leave you alone, or they'll just whatever. You know, you just have to have thick skin, and you just do what feels good for you. So I will say that.
You got to be the trendsetter. I mean, it sounds like you even had an effect on some of your teammates that may have made that switch. So don't worry about it. Yeah, just safety shaming should not be a thing, especially in roller derby. It's such an inclusive, like, you know, kind of it's a great style of community. You know, I'm surprised that that's even an issue.
Well, there's still that idea, you know, it's still very like, we're the badasses, we don't wear all this, you know what I mean. I think that's where it comes from, is that we're badass and we don't need all that stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but I want to walk. I want to leave this sport and be able to walk and run and swim and ride my bike and all that other stuff. So I think it's important to wear what you feel is, you know, protective. And I mean, we wear a lot less protective gear than almost any other contact sport out there, other than rugby, because they're crazy.
Yeah. Oh my God, this guy, you got to have a little insanity in you to play rugby.
Exactly. But I mean, if you think about it, we're wearing metal things on our feet, you know, we've got all this stuff going on, and we wear very little protective gear. So
yeah, it's true.
Whatever it's true. Keeps your body and soul together is a good thing, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, agreed.
All right. So we're going to have to end there, but because we're going to talk a little bit about, you guys are going to consider setting up a podcast of your own.
We are, yeah. We're looking for a little bit of feedback from the listeners, because we've just had some really good questions to come through, and it's kind of spurred some ideas in my mind. Mm-hmm. So if the listeners out there, if you guys think that these two podcasts were valuable and you'd like to hear more, maybe you want to hear from some other doctors who are interested in roller derby. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not a doctor, but you want to hear from some doctors that are interested in roller derby or some other guests, we're thinking of starting a podcast. But we just want to make sure that what we're putting our efforts into event to is going to benefit the Derby community, and there's actually going to be an audience for it. So what we're asking for is if you could just send us a tweet, put a note on our Facebook page, and just let us know if there were a podcast, a Derby injury prevention podcast, would you listen to it? And then let us know, what do you want to hear about? And so, you know, right now we're just a bunch of volunteers, and we're doing this in our spare time, and we really would just want to focus our efforts into what's going to give the greatest impact. And if there's not a need or a want for it, we don't want to go down that direction. So, you know, just let us know if this is something that you think would be valuable. We'd really appreciate it. So,
well, I personally think it would be valuable. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had you on the show.
Yeah. Thank you.
And if you're looking for sponsors, you know, put the call out for sponsorship. I would definitely do it. When the way I've done sponsorship, I've had people sponsor a month on the show. So you could do a month. Maybe you could do episode to episode. But it would be something that, you know, I think the Derby community really needs this. We need a group of physicians and people interested in our safety. We don't have that. Yeah. You know, we just don't. All the other major sports, they have that. They have people that are invested in safety, and we do not. So it would be really amazing if we could just continue to do this and have it grow and have it build. So if you're interested in staying safe in our sport or learning more about safety and prevention of injury, I definitely think this would be a great thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we agree. And yeah, we're certainly looking for sponsors. You can also donate on our website. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. And so you will get a tax deductible donation if you choose to donate to us. But yeah, more to come on that for sure. So, you know, please give us some feedback. And we think we've got some good ideas, but we just want to make sure that it's going to have an impact and be a positive experience for everybody. You know,
can you just say the website and everything and the information for people if they're listening now?
Sure. Sure. Right now, okay, it's probably going to change in the future, but right now it's derbyipn.webs.com. derbyipn@webs.com. Okay.
Excellent.
We're on Twitter at @derbyipn and on Facebook as well, @derbyipn. That's kind of our tagline.
Okay, right now, so IPN, look for that IPN out there.
Yep.
I love it. It sounds great.
Awesome. Awesome. Very good. Thanks again for having me, Q. I really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. And if you're looking at looking to get some gear, you can go to houseofskate.net. House of Skate is spelled with an 8. And use the code ELEKTRA, ELEKTRA, all capital letters, and it will get you 10% off your order. So if you need some new safety gear, like we were talking about, get some new gaskets, get a, you know, possible new helmet, you can go there. And I know that you are looking to set up your podcast and looking to set up anything. And if you have any more questions, please feel free to email me or find Ryan online. And at, you know, what is your Facebook page named exactly so people know?
It is facebook.com/derbyipn.
There you go. So he can answer your questions directly and maybe, you know, cultivate them for the show. I love it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thanks for being on. I really appreciate it. You're very informative and we love having you on.
All right. Thanks a lot, Q. Have a great night.
You too. Bye-bye. Thanks.